Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Russia's defense ministry has announced a 48-hour regime of silence beginning Thursday over the war-torn northern Syrian city Aleppo, where it is backing forces of President Bashar al-Assad. It is unclear who and what territory are covered. The announcement came late Wednesday after U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry expressed growing frustration with Russia and Syria over military action that has undermined a nearly four-month cessation of hostilities. Kerry spoke in the Norwegian capital, Oslo.
So we've made it very clear that unless we get a better definition of how this cessation is going to work, how it will be enforced, who it applies to, how it is applied, we are not going to sit there while Assad continues to offensively assault Aleppo and while Russia continues to support in that effort.
Kerry accused Moscow and Damascus of selectively enforcing the ceasefire while Assad's forces continue their campaign to retake the city. The UN envoy to Central African Republic, Abdoulaye Bathily, warned the Security Council Wednesday the Rebel Lords Resistance Army is stepping up attacks, expanding into new areas, and abducting children.
The LRA continue to threaten the security of the population in its operating area and has notably increased its alleged attack in the Central African Republic during the reporting period, reportedly extending into area that had previously seen little to no LRA movement.
He warned the withdrawal of Ugandan troops from CAR, part of an African Union regional task force, could be exploited by groups like LRA. And Bathily said political tensions are causing instability and hindering development in other countries of the region, including Burundi. This is VOA News. President Obama travels to Orlando, Florida Thursday, site of Sunday's mass shooting at the Pulse nightclub that killed 49, wounded more than 50. He plans to meet with some members of the victims and emergency personnel who responded to the worst mass shooting in U.S. history. Meanwhile, federal agents say the wife of the man who carried out the attack, Omar Mateen, had some knowledge of his plans and may have failed to alert police. A law enforcement official said a federal grand jury will consider whether to bring charges against the wife, Noor Zahi Zalman, one of several people who have been interviewed. Lee Bentley is the U.S. attorney in the case.
We do not know when charges will be finalized. Indeed, we're not sure what charges will be brought or if charges will be brought. I can assure you that we're working with our law enforcement partners to find out everything we can about what happened at the Pulse nightclub.
Investigators allege she went with Mateen on a reconnaissance mission to the club and accompanied him to buy ammunition. But police say she also warned her husband not to carry out the attack. Mateen was killed in a shootout with police. A vessel owned by Deep Ocean Search appears to have found some of the wreckage from that Egypt Air flight that crashed in the Eastern Mediterranean May 19, killing all 66 people on board. Finding the Airbus A320 has been a race against time since battery-powered signals from the jet's flight data and voice recorders are expected to fade away by month's end. A spokesman for UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said Wednesday Mr. Ban has urged East African nations Ethiopia and Eritrea to exercise maximum restraint following Sunday's clashes on their disputed border. The UN chief met Ethiopia's Prime Minister Haile Mariam Desalegn in Brussels Wednesday, while Deputy Secretary General Jan Eliasson phoned Eritrean Foreign Minister Osman Sala Mohamed. They were urged to fully implement a peace agreement signed back in 2000. Policymakers at the U.S. Central Bank are holding the line on a key interest rate in a further effort to stimulate the economy, still showing weakness. Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen told journalists this action should support further progress toward full employment and stable prices.
Today, the Federal Open Market Committee maintained the target range for the federal funds rate at 0.25% to 0.5%. This accommodative policy should support further progress toward our statutory objectives of maximum employment and price stability.
On the same day, Wednesday, U.S. manufacturing output fell in May as vehicle sales fell sharply. Nigeria's central bank says it will begin market-driven currency trading next week, abandoning a nearly 18-month fixed exchange rate policy. The naira had been pegged at 197 to the U.S. dollar. The country faces a foreign currency reserve crisis as oil prices fall. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Thursday, June 16th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Eritrea and Ethiopia are told to settle their border dispute through negotiations.
What we are asking and what the reality dictates is Ethiopia, the aggressor, must be condemned. It is not only Ethiopia that should be condemned. Any country that violates the UN Charter and attack another country must be condemned.
Araya Distad is Eritrea's ambassador to the United Nations. Catholic bishops in Uganda have called on the country's judiciary not to allow itself to be used by the government. Zimbabwe's opposition leader criticizes President Mugabe for his handling of the economy. And today is the 40th anniversary of the 1976 Soweto uprising.
Progress has been made. Yes, political freedom we have achieved, but there's still a lot to be done because young people are now crying. They want economic freedom. They want to be part and parcel of the economy of South Africa.
Moloto Opa is one of the survivors of the 1976 Soweto uprising. A Kenya refugee team aims for an Olympic gold this summer, and a South Sudan rapper speaks out despite threats. Those stories, plus Marco Woman Sports and our Listener of the Day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The international community is urging Ethiopia and Eritrea to exercise restraint and engage in a political discussion to resolve their border dispute. This after the two countries engaged in heavy fighting on Sunday along their Sorena border area. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon met Wednesday with Ethiopian Prime Minister Hailemariam Desalegn in Brussels and urged the leaders of the two Horn of Africa nations to seek a peaceful resolution through political means. Araya Dista, Eritrea's ambassador to the United Nations, tells Henrik Fente of VOA's Horn of Africa service that blanket calls for restraint lack context and that Ethiopia, the aggressor, should first be condemned.
In the first place, to put in power the culprit and the victim is not appropriate and it's not correct. So to call for the both parties to refrain, absolutely out of the loop. This is what we call a diplomatic expediency or political nicety. So what we are asking and what the reality dictates is Ethiopia, the aggressor, must be condemned. It is not only Ethiopia that should be condemned. Any country, any nation that violates the sovereignty of any nation, that violates the rule of law, the UN Charter, and attack another country must be condemned. That's the standard modus operandi of the UN.
Do you see any possibility of a political dialogue here?
What political dialogue? The victims and the culprit cannot be on a par. The culprit has to be condemned. After that, the Ethiopians have also to vacate. They have occupied Eritrean land, sovereign Eritrean, for the last 14 years. They have to vacate that land. After that, political dialogue and other dialogues or any open-ended dialogues are acceptable to Eritrea.
Well, first thing first, one of the points you're making is who fired first. Of course, you're saying Ethiopia is the aggressor. Ethiopia says Eritrea fired first, and the international community is reacting to these conflicting reports coming from Addis Ababa and Asmara, as you can understand.
First, instead of looking at he said, she said, people should do their homework, scratch the surface, and do the fact analysis. First of all, Eritrea has never threatened to take military action against Ethiopia, even though it has occupied its land, even though Eritrea has the right under Article 51 of the UN Charter to take any necessary action to reclaim its land. But we have never used such a threatening thing. But Ethiopia, in Parliament, the Prime Minister has been saying, the officials have been saying, will take surgical and clinical military operation against. They have been saying, this is fact number one. Fact number two, Eritrea has never lied to the international community. Even when Badime was awarded by the EEDC to Eritrea, the Ethiopian government publicly lied to the international community and the Ethiopian people that it was awarded to them. Number three, Ethiopia is the one who has occupied sovereign Eritrean territory for the last 14 years, and it has already violated Eritrea's sovereign territory. So who is really the attacker and who is really the victim can be verified easily by people doing their homework.
Araya Distad is Eritrea's ambassador to the United Nations. You are speaking with Henrik Fente of VOA's Horn of Africa service. Today marks the 40th anniversary of the Soweto student uprising that became a defining moment in the struggle to end apartheid in South Africa. On this day in 1976, South African security forces opened fire on black students who were protesting against a government decision order for schools to teach only in the African language used by whites. At least 170 people were killed and more than 1,000 injured. Moloto Oupa is one of the survivors of the 1976 Soweto uprising. He is also project coordinator of the June 16, 1976 Foundation, which purpose is to preserve the legacy of the 1976 uprising. He says the uprising led to political freedom for black South Africans, but now the young people want economic freedom.
The government of the day wanted to use Afrikaans that we can use to study mathematics, to study biology, of which that was going to be difficult for us, and it was going to set a lot of school kids out of school. So we met at the DOCC on the 13th to plan about the march. On the morning of June 16, we had our usually morning assembly. We had had a meeting prior to the morning assembly where we decided that we're going to march. We have written the placards and placed them around the schoolyard so that our parents should not see those placards and the teachers should not see those placards except the principal at that time. In the morning, we went out singing Senzenina, waving our placards, which had a message. And we went around different schools where we bring together students so that we must have a very big number of students who are marching on the day. When we arrived at Velagazi Street, the police were there, and one officer went out of his car with a loud hailer. He said something, but students were singing, so it was not audible enough for them to hear exactly what was he saying. Before we could understand what was happening, the police released a police dog. It charged at students, but they retaliated by stoning the police dog. That's when then the police started shooting at students. That's where Hector Peterson was shot. That's where Hastings Ndlovu was shot. A lot of young people were shot on the particular day.
Mr. Moloto, could you tell us how many students were killed during that uprising?
It's still a lot of contestation, but I can tell you it was almost 800 students, because on the 17th, people were going to the mortuaries. If you get the report of a Baragwanath hospital, how many students came in there that were shot by the police?
Mr. Oupa Moloto, 40 years later, do you think progress has been made for South Africans, for the students?
A progress has been made. Bantu education was scrapped. Apartheid laws were scrapped. Actually, the action of students in 1976 fast-tracked the release of Nelson Mandela. We were able to vote. Yes, political freedom we have achieved, but there's still a lot to be done because young people are now crying. They want economic freedom, of which is the most difficult struggles young people are faced with today, because they want to be part and parcel of the economy of South Africa. They want to share in the economy.
Moloto Oupa is one of the survivors of the 1976 Soweto student uprising. He was speaking from Soweto, South Africa, with George Sagnon of VOA's French to Africa service. Roman Catholic bishops in Uganda say the country's judiciary is increasingly allowing itself to be used by the government in its disputes with the opposition. The bishops under the Uganda Episcopal Conference also warned Ugandan security agencies against clamping down on the legitimate political activities of the opposition. This comes after former opposition presidential candidate Dr. Chisa Besigye wrote the country's chief justice warning that the independence of the judiciary was gradually being questioned. Monsignor Matthew Odong is vicar of the Archdiocese of Gulu in northern Uganda. He says the bishops want the judiciary to be impartial.
The bishops are concerned about those people who are arrested, and reasons sometimes are not very clear, and sometimes they are taken on to the court. And judiciary being one of the three arms of the government, I think what the bishops are concerned is that their judgment should be just and should not be influenced by the government in any way. They should be guided by the law of the land, by the constitution.
This comes at a time that the court has rejected the government's plea that Dr. Besigye, who has been arrested and charged with treason, should be tried in Kampala and not at Luzira. Do you think this is an improvement?
It's not clear to me whether Dr. Besigye is to be tried in Luzira or in Kampala. You know, I think the concern of the bishops still comes back to the same thing. Is he guilty? The judiciary handling the arrest objectively or due to the influence from the government? So about whether it is Luzira or Kampala, you know, to me, it still just comes back to what the bishops of Uganda are trying to put forward to the government of Uganda and also to the whole world, that the arrest must be genuine and somebody must be proven guilty and also given a moment, you know, to defend himself or herself.
This is a direct attack on the judiciary.
Well, I thought the bishops are very clear into the judiciary to be autonomous and to be guided by the legal principles of justice, of truth, other than, you know, allowing their judgment to be influenced by the government or externally. I think that's what the bishops are.
What if the government says that the bishops are trying to interfere in political matters?
Well, the government could say that, but the bishops are also citizens of the country and they are to be protected by the same constitution and by virtue of their offices, their positions as religious leaders, they also have a right to speak on behalf of those who are arrested and the judiciary look influenced by external force. So the bishops, they've got the right to speak openly that, no, look here. You know, you, the judiciary, you've got to stand on the basic principle of law and let your judgment not be influenced by the government. The church is the voice. The church is the conscience of the society, the voice of the oppressed. And in a situation of injustice, the church cannot keep silent because it will betray its vocation.
Monsignor Matthew Odong is vicar of the Archdiocese of Gulu. He was speaking with me from Gulu, northern Uganda. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington, and today is Thursday, June 16th. Let's send greetings to listeners on our affiliate station, Kira FM, in Jinja, Uganda. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 18 minutes past the hour. In Zimbabwe, opposition movement for democratic change founding President Morgan Tsvangirai says President Robert Mugabe has no clue how to fix the country's ailing economy. Tsvangirai, who is recovering from an undisclosed ailment, claims that President Mugabe's ZANU-PF party has run out of ideas on how to handle the current cash crisis, high unemployment, and other issues. First, Mr. Tsvangirai speaks to reporter Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe program about his health condition.
Not fully recovered, but recovering. You know, after any operation, you need to go through a process of recovery. Surprisingly, I was not even aware of the extent of the ailment, but my goodness, timing was very good, and the operation went successfully.
Is the nature of your ailment something that you want to disclose, or it's between you and your doctors?
Matters of personal health are confidential, but nothing really that should be out of the norm.
Why did you decide to seek medical treatment in South Africa? Was it because of the advice of your doctors or the deteriorating health facilities in Zimbabwe?
It was not even a question of going to South Africa. I went to South Africa for the test for my doctor. The examination would then advise me to go and do some testing in Zimbabwe. After the test in Zimbabwe, they then suggested that I should go and do a more thorough CT scan in South Africa. So I went down. And when I was there, it confirmed the ailment. I then went through the process, and the doctor suggested that we should immediately operate.
There was also talk that...
By the way, it's not a question of choice. I think people must understand that it's a question of to get the best expertise available. Not that there are no experts in Zimbabwe, but I'm sure that people will understand that matters of personal health are confidential.
And then the party is also saying that Mr. Tsvangirai will be leading from the front at this demonstration in Mutare. Are you ready?
If I am fully recovered, yes, definitely it's my responsibility to do that. But if I am not fully recovered, I should allow the body to recover. Otherwise, you push yourself to the wall and lose the whole game. So what's the use of trying to demonstrate that bravado?
Let's talk about the economy, Mr. Tsvangirai. It seems the situation is worsening in Zimbabwe. What is your take on what is happening?
Well, everyone will confirm to you that it's a dire strait. The country is going through a dire strait. We've never experienced this, where everyone has now become poor. You can't withdraw your money. The banks have no money. And it's affecting consumer demand. It is a desperate situation. And I think everyone agrees that something must be. How long do we continue on this state of affairs where the government, even in spite of the outcry of the people, seems to insist on the worst policy decision that they have taken?
Monkey Tsvangirai is leader of the Movement for Democratic Change Party. He was speaking from Harare with reporter Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe program. In South Sudan, rapper Luol Dhawal uses his music to speak out against a government with a reputation for silencing dissenting voices. Jason Pantinkin reports from Juba.
For South Sudanese rapper Luol Dhawal, music can be an act of political defiance. He took the stage at this nightclub in Juba the day after soldiers stormed another venue to stop his performance. On another occasion, his fans had to smuggle him out the back to avoid arrest.
Hip-hop is a type of music where you talk, you pass messages and talk about the suffering of the people and be the voice of the voiceless, basically. And I feel like South Sudan, there's a lot of people who are voiceless. A lot of injustice, a lot of unfairness.
Luol is one of South Sudan's most popular rappers. Raised in the United States, Luol returned to what was then Southern Sudan in 2009 in hopes of helping the country grow. South Sudan got its independence 2 years later, but has known little besides war, poverty, and corruption since. Luol's lyrics push the boundaries of free speech in a country where perceived government critics have been jailed, beaten, or killed. The government banned one of Luol's most popular songs, called Dola Jadid, from playing on local radio stations. Dola Jadid means new nation in the local Arabic language. In it, Luol criticizes local officials who he says always reply, "We're a new nation," as an excuse for the lack of public services like water and electricity. Luol says he received death threats after releasing that song.
It's just people trying to rattle me, trying to scare me, and trying to get me to sing things that make no sense or talk about falseness and fake things that are not really happening, clubbing and what, but that's not the reality in South Sudan.
Luol says he won't give in to intimidation.
I just have to be myself. I can't change for any intimidation or any fear because you only live once and I cannot live like a coward.
With South Sudan emerging from a 2.5-year civil war that has divided the country by tribe, Luol says he wants to preach unity.
Music brings people together. And that's what we need right now, this time of peace and reconciliation. We need to unify and have that nationhood, that love for South Sudan, you know? Because we're all South Sudanese at the end of the day.
He's working on a new album, collaborating with producers and singers from the country's various ethnicities. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Juba.
Kenya is hosting 5 of the 10 athletes who will compete in this year's Rio Summer Olympics as part of a new refugee Olympic team. The International Olympic Committee says it hopes the team will be a symbol of hope and a reminder of the magnitude of the global refugee crisis. Lenny Ruvaga went to Ngong, Kenya, where some members of the team are training and has this report.
The phrase Breakfast of Champions has taken on new meaning here at the Tegla Larupe Training Center for Refugee Athletes. 5 of these athletes, now munching on a nutritious meal of bread, fruits, and tea, will represent refugees around the world at the Rio Games this August. All five originally come from South Sudan. Runner Rose Natike Lokonyen was just 4 years old when her family fled ethnic conflict in the eastern part of the country. She has lived at the Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya for the past 16 years. She thinks of her two youngest brothers often. She had to leave them at Kakuma to come here to train.
I hope I'll do well and get some gold or silver as well if I win. Then I really miss my sibling because since we came to Kakuma, we came together with our parents, but they left. Then I stay with them as well. And here, these are my two siblings whom I took them. They are the youngest one, and these are the two boys who are underage, and now I left them alone.
She says there are good days and bad days in training, but she was headstrong from an early age. She remembers her father punishing her for playing soccer.
When I do escape, going to the field, after coming to the field, he do beat me. In fact, I really miss him now because he was just looking after me.
The team has a tough training regimen. Every morning, they start with stretching exercises, which last for 45 minutes. Then the team runs for about 2 hours a day. Lokonyen's event is the 800 meters. It may be no accident that the five refugee Olympians that Kenya is hosting will compete in track and field events. This training camp is named after Kenyan marathon runner Tegla Lorupe, who holds several world records. Jackson Kimoi is the manager of the Olympians training camp. He is hopeful about the prospects in Rio.
They had good time in our trials, so that's the special thing they have. But another thing, they are also disciplined, and that's what we needed most.
Now, they will run for gold. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Ngong, Kenya.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Swaziland pipped Madagascar by a solitary goal as Zimbabwe beat Seychelles 5-0. In Group A action at the Council of Southern Africa Football Association's COSAFA Cup in Windhoek, Namibia on Wednesday. As a result, Swaziland topped the group with 7 points and advanced to the quarterfinals. Zimbabwe has 5 points, Madagascar 4, and Seychelles have no point. Today, Thursday, in Group B action, Angola play Mauritius as Malawi tackle Lesotho. Moving on to athletics, world record holder David Rudisha of Kenya and Ethiopian former world indoor champion Mohamed Aman face off in 800 meters at the IAAF Diamond League in Stockholm, Sweden today, Thursday. Eritrean Zerzanei Tadesa will challenge the Ethiopian 5,000-meter dominance of Yomif Kejelcha, Mukhtar Edris and Yeneo Alamireo. Ivory Coast's Winfried Kofi and Ben Youssef Meite sprint in men's 100 meters as Marie-Jose Talou sprints in the women's 200 meters. Kenyan world champion Nicholas Bett and South African Louis van Zyl run the 400-meter hurdles. Morocco's Rababi Arafi and Kenya's Hellen Obiri clash in women's 1,500 meters. Ethiopian Olympic bronze medalist Sofia Sefa, Algerian Amina Betishi challenge Tunisian Olympic silver medalist Habiba Gribi in women's 3,000-meter steeplechase. On the infield, Republic of Congo's Frank Elembe and Nigerian Tosin Oke compete in short put and triple jump respectively, while Kenya's world champion Julius Yego and Egypt's world championship silver medalist Ihab Abdelrahman El Sayed contest the javelin. In volleyball, Tunisia play Venezuela in the World Men's Volleyball League Group 3 in Ljubljana, Slovenia, tomorrow, Friday. On Saturday, they face Qatar before challenging host Slovenia on Sunday. Finally, in rugby, Brazil host Kenya in a first-ever 15-a-side rugby test match in Rio de Janeiro on Saturday. And that's it for Daybreak African Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark, and have a good day. And that's it for this June 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. I'm James Butte in Washington.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in feast your ears and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.